He says, to everything there's a season, there's a duration, a time for every person, purpose under heaven. And now he's going to talk about, it's a poem made up of 14 opposites, and it really encapsulates pretty much everything that will run in the life. And so he says concerning life, there's a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck what is planted. To everything, turn, turn, turn. There is a season. Turn, turn, turn. Wait a second. Somebody supplied me with the proper thing for this. We couldn't get the birds to come in and do this for us tonight, and so we'll do the best that we can. I would like a tambourine or something, though. Can we get some? Thank you, whoever provided this for me. Well, the birds try to glamorize this, and sometimes you can hear on the radio where this will be read or something like that, and it's the idea, it's always in some favorable kind of a way. That's not the way that Solomon is using it. He is talking about when he's confronted with the utter monotony of life. He's tired of it. And so this is better how it's read. And you can't put a song unless you want to make a funeral dirge out of it. To everything there's a season. Time for every purpose under heaven. A time to be born. A time to die. A time to plant. A time to pluck up what's planted. A time to kill. A time to heal. A time to break down. A time to build up. A time to weep. And a time to laugh. A time to mourn. And a time to dance. A time to cast away stones. And a time to gather stones. A time to embrace. And a time to refrain from embracing. A time to gain and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to throw away. You get your garage sales right in there. A time to tear and a time to sow. And a time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time of war and a time of peace. And so He's down. The life just, it just rolls. It just comes and it comes in these pieces and in these contrasts, and all you can do is just roll with how it comes. And then in verse 9 he says, what profit has the worker from that in which he labors? In other words, everything that I do that is constructive in life can be wiped out in a moment by that which is destructive in life. And so, you know, he's down. He said, I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. And so he looks at life as a gift from God. And here is the thing now that saves him from the utter melancholy of fatalism. And he says, and he, God, has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in there, in man's hearts, except that no man can find out the work that God does from the beginning to end. In other words, nobody can fully understand God. But he recognizes there's all of this monotony in life, but the thing that keeps him from sinking completely into fatalism is he realizes that within his heart and within the hearts of man, eternity's been placed in our heart. We are different from everything else in this world. There's the attempt of the evolutionist to say that we are really a glorified animal, that we're on the same plane as the beasts or anything like that. We are capable of the greatest of horrors, but we weren't created that way. It's because of our sinful nature. But we have been created entirely different from the animals. We have been created in the image of God. And we have been created, as we saw this morning, created for relationship with God. There is that unending sense within our lives that there must be something more to life, there must be something more to life, there must be something more to life, because there is something more to life for the human being, and that something more to life is a relationship with God. And we will never be satisfied until we are engaged in that relationship. Again, I repeat it, but I'll get to other books and I won't repeat it for 2 years. When you have been created for something, you can only be satisfied when you are doing that for which you've been created. And when we've been created for relationship with God, that's the only place that we're going to find satisfaction. And so man can never be satisfied with the temporal. He can't be satisfied with just the day rolling in and all of this stuff, one thing, another thing, another thing, and all of this, because we've been made for eternity. We've been made for relationship with God. We've been made for eternal life with God. Someone has said that man is incurably religious. Well, if by that they meant that we have eternity in our hearts, then that's correct, because we do have eternity in our hearts, and we can't be satisfied until we're in that relationship with God that comes through the Lord Jesus. Someone has said that every human being is born with a cross-shaped hole in their heart, an empty spot in our hearts, and that you can pour the entire world into that hole and never satisfy it. The only thing that can satisfy it is that cross that allows me to have relationship with the Father through His Son, our Lord Jesus. An eternal thirst can never be satisfied with the temporal. As we saw again this morning, the themes are very, very similar. And we saw with that woman that was at the well, and there she was, and five husbands, and now given up on marriage, and and now just living with guys. Or by the time you've been married five times, and now someone will say, "I'm not going to marry you. There's nothing you can offer me that you haven't offered to someone before me. I'll put a roof over your head. I'll feed you for what you can supply for me, but marriage is out." And it's a terrible kind of a life. But here she is. She's trying to find satisfaction in life through relationships with other people, through men. And Jesus spoke to her concerning the water that he asked for a drink of water from her. And he said, "Whoever drinks of this water will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never thirst, but the water that I will give him, it will become in him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life." And so that satisfaction can only come through a relationship with the Lord. And there's that longing for it because eternity has been put in our hearts. Verse 12, "I know that there is nothing better for them," for man, "than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all of his labor. It's the gift of God." And so he's saying, listen, I mean, this is the way that it is, and so enjoy, and just enjoy life. Don't forget to enjoy life. And he continually comes back to this. Every time he kind of gets all the way down, I mean, just where he's about to need therapy or something, he jumps in and says, "Oh, well, we've got to enjoy life," and it kind of helps him out. Verse 14, he says, "I know that whatever God does, it'll be forever. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing can be taken away from it. God does it that men should fear before him." In other words, it's all set. God has got it all in place. There's nothing you can do to change it. And then he gives a kind of a definition in verse 15 of eternity. See if you like this one. "That which is has already been, and that which is to be has already been, and God requires an account of what is past." Solomon's lost me in that old thing. But so that's the case with most descriptions of eternity that I've heard. But I do know that God is outside the time-space continuum, and I'm working on that. And I know Chuck Missler is going to help me with this. But here he's trying to talk about eternity and all of that. And I know that there's an answer for it, and I know that some of you know the answer. And leave me alone after the service. I don't want an answer. Eternity is eternity to me. It's a mystery, and I'm happy with it. And so just instead buy me a candy bar or something. Verse 16. He says, "Moreover, I saw under the sun, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there." You know, where righteousness should be, wickedness was there. "And in the place of righteousness, iniquity or wickedness was there." And so here he is, as he looks at life, and he says, "Everywhere I turn around, I see injustice in life. And I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, and there shall be a time there for every purpose and for every work." He looks at the injustices in life, and it really troubles him. It troubles him concerning the existence of God. It troubles him concerning his fellow man. And yet there's a sense within his heart, again, that eternity that's been built into his heart, that man really deserves to be judged. Now, I don't understand how we can have a judicial system, however flawed that it might work. We have a judicial system where there is a sense that when a person kills another person, that there ought to be a recompense as it relates to that. There should be a judgment associated with that. But somehow, God is not free to judge sin. And so we look, and it's funny, people look and say, well, how could a God of love do this? Or how could God judge? And I can't believe that God would send anyone to hell and all of these kinds of things. And then so often you'll see in some high-profile murder case or something, oh, just pick anyone out of your hat in the last 3 or 4 years. But and there's a sense that maybe some injustice has been done there. And then the victims, they console themselves in the fact that one day God will do what is just in that situation because he knows everything. So people are goofy. On the one hand, they don't like the fact that he is going to judge and judge righteously. And then a moment later, they console themselves in the fact that he's going to, and ultimately justice is going to reign. And so it's all of, you know, the confusion that he's in the middle of. He said, I said in my heart, verse 18, concerning the estate of the sons of men, that God test them that they may see that they themselves are like beasts. For what happens to the sons of men also happens to beasts. In other words, we die. One thing befalls them, as sure as one dies, so dies the other. Surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over beasts, for all is vanity. One thing he keeps going back to, he's troubled by, is death. Now, one great thing about Solomon is the whole time he's in this thing, he is thinking. He does not have his mind in neutral as he's going through life. Now, he's trying to find life in the wrong places, but he's thinking about things every step of the way. And one of the great needs today, and one of the great competitions that entertainment, you know, poses so often to God, is that how much time in the American life is there to stop and to think about the issues of life. But he looks and he can't get away from the fact that I'm going to die. No matter how much education I have, I'm going to die. No matter how much wealth I have, I'm going to die. No matter how many kids I have, I'm going to die. No matter, you know, how powerful I get, I'm going to die. He's searching continually for that answer to death that he knows is coming his way. And as he looks at life under the sun, outside of, the context of relationship with God, he says, well, man is really no greater than any of the animals. We just kind of die. We fall to the side of the ground and they just bury us like they bury an oxen. And it's all the same thing. All go to one place. Verse 20. All are from the dust and all return to the dust. And so here we have the whole idea of evolution. There's no soul, there's no spirit within man. We're just a glorified animal. And just do the best that you can and enjoy yourself as much as you can. But again, the Bible teaches that we've been created in the image of God, and that we were created perfect, and that we have fallen from that perfection. And again, it's very important to understand that God has given us a proof for the fact that we were once something superior and we have fallen from that something superior, and that we are not evolving into something superior. And the proof is the existence of conscience within our lives. Romans chapter 2. Every one of us in this room, all 6 billion people in this planet, every one of us has a conscience. A sense that there is a right and there is a wrong, and that I should always do right and I should never do wrong. But there is with that conscience, the sense, that realization that even though I know that I ought to always do right and never do wrong, that the standard of my conscience is higher than my conduct. And that reveals that the origin of my conscience must be higher than myself. The origin of my conscience is from God, and my conscience speaks to me every day and declares to every human being in this world that where we were created something superior, we have fallen from that something superior, and that we are not evolving into something greater. We are different from the the animals. Who knows, verse 21, the spirit of the sons of men, which goes upward, and really in the Hebrew it can be if it goes upward, and the spirit of the beast, whether it goes down to the earth, which goes down to the earth, and it could be if it goes down to the earth. He's saying, how do we know that man's, you know, goes in one direction, and our end, as it relates to afterlife, is any different from the beast? And so I perceived that there is nothing better than a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage, for who can bring him to see what will happen after him? And so he perks himself up with the idea of a good meal and a nice cold drink. Lemonade is what I have in mind, so don't get into the thing. So here he gets all the way down in this funk, and then now he comes back in and says, all right, let's just kind of enjoy ourselves. And so he falls into fatalism. And one of the problem is if you believe in fatalism, and a lot of times that's where you're forced to go if you're not going to believe in the existence of God, that this thing just kind of plays out the way that it's going to play out, fate rules, is once that becomes the predominant philosophy within a human being or among the people on this earth, what it does is it nurtures a selfishness in my life. It's called egoism. And so now I look and I say, well, everyone's been dealt their hand. You've been dealt your hand. I've been dealt my hand. And so if my hand is a good hand and your hand is a lousy hand, how can I help you? You got a lousy hand. That's the hand you got. And so what it does is it nurtures selfishness within my life. It tells me that it's okay for me to live. The highest goal in my life is to live for myself. And that's what he heads into. And when I start to live for myself as the supreme thing in my life, there's consequences to it. And one of those things is oppression. He says, chapter 4, verse 1, then I returned and I considered all of the oppression that is under the sun, all of the exploitation of one man towards other men. Well, you know, if there isn't a God, and everyone's been dealt a hand, and fate is going to win anyway, and no matter what you do, you can't change fate, then what's the motivation to help anybody else? The motivation now becomes, get as much as I can. So, you have in India, where Hinduism prevails, and there is that idea of reincarnation, and that what a person is born into in this life, they need to be born into their human condition. They may have been animals in the past. They come in, here they are a beggar, and maybe they've got an amputated leg or whatever it might be, or some kind of a deformity, and they need to be that way in this life, so that they can suffer in this life appropriately, and then in their next life, take the next jump up and maybe be in a middle-income household in the United States of America, or whatever it might be. So what it allows me to do is to look at them and not help them. And it allows me not to help them and be absolutely guilt-free in terms of my conscience. And so it turns into oppression. I'm going to oppress them. They've been put there, you know, by whatever means to be oppressed as a part of the overall cycle. So it leads to oppression, taking advantage of other human beings. And look, the tears of the oppressed, but they have no comforter. And on the side of their oppressor, there was power. These, you know, there's oppressors, they've got all of the power here, but they have no comforter, those that are oppressed. And therefore, I praise the dead who were already dead more than the living who are still alive. Yet better than both is the man who had never existed, who had never seen the evil work that is done under the sun. So he's walking through life, he's looking at life, he sees all of the unfairness of life, he sees how man treats other men, he sees the oppression of it, and as he looks at the whole thing, he says, listen, it would be better to be dead than to be a part of that whole scene. And better than living and seeing this and dying, it would be better never to have lived at all. Maybe you felt that way at some time in your life, where you just look and you say, it'd be better to be dead than to watch what I have to watch on in this world day in and day out. Now, we live in a country where we have a bit of a buffer. We have a buffer because we have a certain element of freedom that not the rest of the world has. And so there's that ability, even though it's not perfect, to work myself up through the system and improve my lot. But in vast segments of the world, there is no opportunity to do that. And when you're face to face with that day in and day out and day in and day out, you just look at it and it disheartens you. Is it better if I had never lived than to watch all of this pain that those people are going through, and better yet, never to have lived at all? It's a perky little thing, isn't it, that we're in the middle of? Well, that fatalism that leads to the selfishness, it doesn't just lead to oppression, but it leads to envy. He said in verse 4, again, I saw that for all toil and every skillful work. Here you got a worker. He's a hard worker and he's skilled in his work. And as a result, he's probably going to make some money at it. And as he does, he's a man that is envied by his neighbor. And this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. And so here he takes and he works hard. He becomes wealthy. And then what happens? You think, oh, I'm going to be satisfied with my wealth. And all it does is provoke envy in the rest of the people. They look, and then the government decides that they need to engage in a campaign of redistribution of wealth. But anyway, that's another story. So, but there is that whole thing that goes on where, it provokes an envy in that, and especially if I do it out of selfishness and without concern for others. The fool, verse 5, folds his hands. In other words, he wants to sleep a little longer, and he consumes his own flesh. He doesn't work hard enough to get enough to eat. And better is a handful with quietness than both hands full, together with toil and grasping for the wind. And so that selfishness leads to envy, and then it leads to loneliness. Verse 7, then I returned, and I saw vanity under the sun. There is one alone without a companion. And so here's a man, gives himself to selfishness in his life. I exist in order to satisfy myself. And what happens to that kind of a person? You end up lonely. You know why you end up lonely? You end up alone. Nobody can stand to be around you. And so here's this person. He absolutely thrives under this system of selfishness, but he doesn't have any friends. He has neither son, and who's going to marry him? He doesn't have a brother. He's driven him off. In other words, he doesn't get close to people. Why? Because people have needs, and then you'd have to share some of your stuff with them. And so he's not interested in that, so he ends up alone. And there is no end to all of his labors. He works hard, but he's not satisfied with the riches. But he never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? This also is vanity and a grave misfortune. And so he's working hard. He's becoming tremendously wealthy, but he's all alone. He's all alone. No one to share it with. And so that selfishness, what it does is it blinds a person to the fact that the most valuable thing in this world is not more treasure, but relationships. Relationships. And you'd think, boy, the more wealth a person would get, the more generous they would get, or the more kind they would get to people. But very often, that isn't the case at all. They get more and more stingy, and more selfish, and more isolated. Now, in verse 9, Solomon gives several examples of where cooperation is better than selfishness. He said, two are better than one because they have good reward for their labor. There are just some jobs that go a lot quicker when there's two of you to do it, rather than three people working individually on that same job. It is helpful and hard work. It's also cooperation has an advantage over isolation. If they fall, one will lift them up. So when you're in trouble and in difficulty, it's good to have a friend. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Again, if two lie down together and it's freezing cold, they'll keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? And so the cooperation, it can lead to warmth if you're in a bad way that way. Though one may be empowered by another, two can overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. And so cooperation is advantageous when I get attacked, or somebody, you know, criminal comes and wants to overpower me. Two people have a tremendous advantage in that kind of a situation. Jesus thought that life could never be found in selfishness. could never be found in selfishness. But life would be found, and my life being buried as a seed, me dying to myself, and now living for God and living for others. That's where life is really found. Living for God, loving God with all of my heart, mind, soul, and strength, and then loving my neighbor as myself. What a life that is found there. Not in isolation, not in selfishness. Well, he tries all of this, just selfishness. He finds he's empty and frustrated in that. And so he says, surely what I'm looking for is I just need some popularity. I'll be satisfied when I become popular, when they've got a spread on me in People magazine. And so he tries for popularity in verse 13, and he says, better is a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more, a king that's unteachable. For he, the young man, comes out of prison to be king, replacing the old king. And although he was born poor in his kingdom, I saw all the living who walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in his place. So he looks at the crowd, the older king. He was once real popular. Now he gets put out of the way, and this new young guy comes up. He becomes king. Everybody thinks he's the greatest. His, approval ratings are very high. Then verse 16, there was no end of the people over whom he was made king. They all love him. Yet those who come afterward will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. And so he'll be in office. He'll be the king for a while, and then pretty soon a whole bunch of people won't want him to be the king anymore. And so the goofy thing about popularity is, here today, gone tomorrow. Isn't that true? One day you got the movie star. He's making $8 million. No, let me be realistic. $75 million for one movie. And then he gets a couple of bombs, in there. And then pretty soon he's making $1.75, or he's, looking to do a commercial or something like that. Though they're making a lot of money on commercials over in Japan. Did you read that? A lot of that stuff. There's no bearing on what we're looking at, but it came into my mind and I thought I would mention that to you. But here, you see the same thing? It's played out every single day on the athletic fields, isn't it? Maybe you're a Giants fan. And you hate the dreaded Dodger Blue. And they're in a bit of a pennant race right now. I don't know if you've noticed that. But I don't know who won today. Don't shout out. I don't want you to be that current on these things. But they've got a reliever by the name of Beck on that team. And sometimes he struggles. I mean, sometimes he goes out there and, man, he just strikes out the side and he saves the game. And then sometimes he serves up like underhanded softball pitches and they launch him into the upper deck and that kind of thing. One day, man, he is like the hero of the whole world. And the next day, no telling what's going to come out of the stands to be thrown at him. And it's the same thing in all of the sports. It's the way people are fickle. Not us. Not us. I mean, other people outside of this room. People are very, very fickle. And so if I'm going to live for popularity, emptiness and frustration is a terrible life. Now, he, in chapter 5, heads in, he decides, it would appear, that he's going to try and find the purpose in life in religion. And so he's going to talk about what not to do in terms of religion, which leads me to believe that he got into the religious system there, and what he was confronted with when he went to temple or he went to whatever was a religious system that was just, it was mindless, it was heartless, it was all external that was going on as it related to his life. And so he tried religion and he was bummed out by it, it appears, and then he's going to give a couple of lessons on how people ought to be in religion. And so he tries religion, and that's going to leave him empty and frustrated too. He said, walk prudently when you go to the house of God and draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools. In other words, go there to hear what God has to say rather than talk, for they do not know that they do evil. He said, do not be rash with your mouth, and so let not your heart utter anything hastily before God. He says, apparently he's in that religious environment, and he said, man, people were praying the nuttiest things to God. And he says, don't do that. For God is in heaven and you're on earth, and therefore let your words be few, for a dream comes through much activity, and a fool's voice is known by his many words. Sounds like he was in a pretty rough service, didn't he? Sounds like a little bit out of control, where somebody got to go on and on and on about something other than the preacher. And so he's a little disappointed with it. So he says, not too many words in there. And then he says, when you make a vow to God, don't delay to pay it, for God has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you vowed. It's better not to vow than to vow and not pay. And so he says, now pay your vows and do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the works of your hands? For in the multitude of dreams, many words, and many words, there is also vanity, but fear the Lord. Now, very often in Christianity, we'll hear, I haven't heard it so much, in the last 10 years or so, but, prior to that, there was a saying where people would constantly say, Christianity isn't a religion, it's a relationship. And that's true. And the idea was, if you're going to define religion, in their mind, the definition of religion was man in his own efforts trying to reach up to God, up to heaven, to make himself acceptable by religious activity to God. That is religion, reaching up. And then Christianity is something completely different from religion, defined in that way, and that is Christianity is God reaching down to man. They are two entirely different things. One is trying to earn from God. The other is a response to God's love. Now, I believe that our word religion comes from a Latin word that means to link. And in a very real sense, Christianity is the only religion in the world because it is the only link between God and man. And we are linked through the person of Jesus Christ. There is one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus. So he tries the religious system of trying to, earn God's favor and to do good and that kind of a thing. And he says that comes up empty too. Verse 8. He talks about the vanity of politics here. Oh boy. He said, if you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province or a county, so to speak, do not marvel at the matter. Well, why is there anarchy in that province? He said, for high official watches over high official, and higher officials are over them. Images are in my mind right now. This is the whole hierarchy in the bureaucracy is in. He says, moreover, the profit of the land is for all. The king himself is served from the field. So he gives himself to politics and says, I will be satisfied here with here. I'll find the purpose of life in politics, and I'll give myself to it. And he discovers as he gives himself to it that politics, the political system that he was under, not the one that we're under today, was entirely corrupt. And he thought to himself, how can something that corrupt have anything but a corrupting influence on its citizenry? So he looks and says, the solution for man, the solution for man's problems and man's life and man's heart is going to have to come from someplace else other than what man can legislate, because those who are in those positions are corrupt like everyone else. Now he returns to his theme of the emptiness of riches, and he says, he who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. In other words, riches can't satisfy. Now, I don't know how many of you are rich in this room, but you don't have to be rich to understand this whole thing. Have you ever wanted some particular item in your life? I remember when I was a kid in elementary school, I was really into pocket knives. And I'd go down to Merle's. Or Merrill's or whatever. Is it Merrill's? Not Merle's. Our town wasn't that small. Went down to Merle's. Went down to Merle's. It was kind of a drugstore, and as a kid, they had all of those pocket knives behind the glass.
all those neat pocket knives. And I remember I saved my money, and I got a pocket knife. You got that pocket knife, and you go out, and you just find some wood. You just throw it into the wood. You throw it into the ground. I mean, you just throw in that pocket knife. That's what we would do in between starting fires. We were a little unsupervised as children. And so, you know, it was a stroke of genius to give me enough money to get a pocket knife. But I had a pocket knife. And you're satisfied with that pocket knife for what? About 48 hours. And then you go in there, and they got pocket knives with spoons. And knives and forks, and they got the little toothpick pocket knife and all that kind of stuff. And pretty soon, you want one of those pocket knives. And that's the way that it is. You can take a pocket knife, or you can do a Lexus. It doesn't matter. All that thing. I'm perfectly satisfied with my 1997 Lexus until I see the 1998 catalogs. And now all of a sudden, they got some different things on there that mine doesn't have. Now, I don't have a Lexus, for those of you sweating bullets. I'm not saying that you can't have one and all, but there is, no matter whether it's a small thing or a large thing, there is something in our heart that getting something is not going to satisfy. Godliness, a relationship with God, with contentment, is great gain. A relationship with God where I'm content with whatever He brings into my life, that makes me a rich man, not in getting more and more things. And I'm never going to be satisfied, this desire for riches, by getting more riches, because it can't satisfy. He said, when goods increase, they increase who eat them. Isn't that the truth? In other words, you get more riches, and what happens? It complicates your life. What did somebody say? I didn't hear. So, your friends come around. Yeah, I thought somebody said you get pregnant. And you have more children or something like that. But you do. You have the goods, they increase. And then all of a sudden, I'm completely thrown off now at this point. No, they increase who eat them. So life gets complicated. And so what profit have the owners except to see them with their own eyes? In other words, the only satisfaction is I look at my W-2 and I say, wow, I made that much this year. But it's all gone because, it got eaten up in the course of the year. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet. And the idea is that he's probably not very wealthy, but he works very hard, whether he eats little or much. There's something about hard work that allows you to get a good night's sleep, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. In other words, there's something about riches that causes you to be worried about your riches. If I see my riches as being something that I possess apart from the Lord, now you can have riches and see it as a stewardship from the Lord, and then you can sleep with it. But more riches, you think, oh, that'll be the end of my problems. I'll never worry. Oh, you know, it isn't. It isn't true. There is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun, riches kept for their owner to his own hurt. In other words, there's the idea concerning riches that if I just get a certain amount, then I'll be satisfied. But it's interesting, you say, if I just can get a million, then I'll be satisfied. But you get a million, and then you realize, man, a million doesn't go as far as it used to go. And I probably need 2 million. Let's see, I'm probably going to, you know, if I live according to the estimates of the census of the United States of America and that kind of thing, adult male born in this, I might live to about 76 years old if the Lord tarries, and if He has that kind of grace on me, I'm about here now. No, I'm going to need 10 million, I think. I think with the way inflation's going and all that kind of stuff. And so there's that idea that somehow I'm going to be freed from my greed if once I have a certain amount of money. Then, once I get this amount of money, then I'll become very generous. It very rarely happens. There's something about gaining money that in many, many people, not all of them, it makes them more greedy than they have ever been in their life. But those whose riches perish through misfortune, when he begets a son, there is nothing in his hand. In other words, riches cannot protect me. It can't provide me with peace because it can't protect me from disaster. It can't protect me from getting wiped out in this world. And so the source of my peace has to be greater than anything that would rob me of my peace. And so money can never provide peace. My peace is going to come from the Lord alone because only He is greater than the things that would rob me of my peace in this world. He said, as he came from his mother's womb, verse 15, naked shall he return. In other words, the way you came in is how you're going to go out. And so to go as he came, and he shall take nothing from his labor which he may carry away in his hand. And this also is a severe evil, that just exactly as he came, so shall he go. In other words, even if you don't lose the money in this life, you'll lose it at death. You're going to leave all of it behind, because you can't take it with you. And so all that labor apart from God, just to leave it behind. And what profit has he who has labored for the wind? And all his days he also eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow and sickness and anger. In other words, money can't buy happiness. Can't buy happiness. A person can be fabulously wealthy and live an utterly lonely life, and live a life consumed, as he says here, with sorrow and sickness and anger and in bitterness. It cannot provide happiness. Here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all of his labor in which he toils under the sun all of the days of his life, which God gives him, for it is his heritage. And so he's talking about only God can give us the ability to enjoy life. And he goes back to that enjoying life. Don't forget to enjoy life as you're living here. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it. In other words, God gives that ability to enjoy the things that we're blessed with, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God, for he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. In other words, he's telling us to, it talks about dwell, and the word not dwell there means to remember. It means to remember, to enjoy life, so that when you get to the end of life, you can look back on life and realize, hey, I enjoyed life while I was living it here. And there's nothing wrong with enjoying life as a child of God. Chapter 6. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is common to man. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so that he lacks nothing for himself of all that he desires, and yet God does not give him the power to eat of it, but a foreigner consumes it. This is vanity, and it is an evil affliction. In other words, money can't buy security. You can gain all that money, but you can't protect that someone isn't going to come in and rip you off from it, whether it's an invasion from another country or whatever it might be, or one of those telephone calls that you get at dinner time where they're trying to get all your money, whatever the kind of, you get those, does everyone get those calls, or we just got that number? I mean, is that like, gosh, it's a good test, I guess. It really is, isn't it? You know, to see how I'm growing in the Lord, for how we handle those kinds of calls. And in my household, we all handle them a little bit differently, and with more or less patience. So they come in trying to sell you some kind of a deal, and especially for those of you who have money, you know, they'll target you. I don't know what list you end up on, and pretty soon every salesman in the world is calling you to try and separate you from your wealth. It's like those faith wallets that they had in the body of Christ. You know, I mean, if what they had was so great, they ought to have no trouble getting money. Pump all your money into it and do fine. That is like the church. You know, remember they had that thing in the body of Christ where some of the TV evangelists were giving you the faith wallets, and you'd send in an offering, and they'd send you a wallet, and then if you have enough faith, there's always going to be money in the wallet and that kind of thing. Well, you know, if those little faith wallets work so well, why are they asking for my money? I'll just get about 10,000 of them and go check them every morning like they would the hen house, and take care of their ministry. You know, things break down. You just look at them just a little bit under the surface. A lot of things break down. If a man begets 100 children, oh no, 100 children. Can you imagine? Just take a moment, parents, and think about that. 100 little whippersnappers running around the house. If a man, it doesn't say he did, but if a man, he's in the theoretical here, if a man begets 100 children and lives, It's just if a woman begets 100 children and lives. And I'm assuming Solomon had quite a few wives and concubines. No woman would want to have 100 children. And so if a man begets 100 children and lives many years, in other words, now he decides he's going to try and find fulfillment in life and having children and then, getting a running machine and living as long as he can and long life. And he says, if a man begets 100 children and he lives many years so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with goodness, or indeed he has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better than he. For it, speaking of the stillborn child, comes in vanity and departs in darkness, and its name is covered with darkness. So he's saying it's better not to have even lived than to come into this world and have a bunch of children and live a long life, and then when you die, nobody shows up at your funeral. What good is a life like that? That, you know, you've got all of the family and all of the wealth and all the everything, and when you die, there's not a single person that then comes into your funeral. And so it's empty just to have children. And I remember, as I mentioned it before, and I know that everything I've mentioned before that you commit to automatic memory, so I don't know why I even preface these things. But, Ann Landers did have survey of parents and how many of them would have children again if they had it to do over again. And it was at least over a majority, I think it was 80%, wrote in and said they would not have children again if they had it to do over again, which tells me how effective her column is among her readers in terms of equipping them for these kinds of things. But I'll tell you, I wouldn't want to raise a child apart from the Lord. And so when they come up with an 80 percentile like that, I'm not shocked at all. Not shocked at all. One of the greatest blessings in my life and in Karen's life is that we got to raise our children in the Lord. Now, some of you come to know the Lord. Your children were already on a bit of a track, in terms of age before you came to know the Lord. But I look and as our daughters are getting married and all, one is married and the other is going to get married, and it's with real satisfaction that we've been able to raise them up in the Lord, and I'll be able to say on that wedding day and then say to Karen, as I have already spoken to her on it, and be able to look and say, our lives have been successful. Our lives have been successful. Whatever does or does not happen the rest of our life, we're successful. And all because of grace, we got to train them up in the ways of the Lord. And then what they do with their life from here, of course, that's their choice. But to raise a child apart from the Lord, I wouldn't want to do it. I pity people as I watch them attempt to do it, because no child was ever intended by God to ever be raised apart from Him. And raising children apart from the Lord has to be what? Empty and frustrating. That's the way it is. And so he tried it. And long life, when you live your long life and no one comes to your funeral, that's a life that is empty and frustrating. He said in verse 5, though it has not seen the sun, talking of the stillborn child, it better be stillborn than to enter into that kind of a life, or known. This has more rest than that man, even if he lives 1,000 years twice over, but has not seen goodness. Do not all go to one place. And so he's cynical. He just looks and he just says, man, in this life, it'd be better to have been stillborn than to have raised, children and tried to make that the satisfaction of my life rather than pleasing the Lord or trying to live a long life and not being a friend to anyone. All of the labor of man, verse 7, is for his mouth. He works to eat, and yet the soul is not satisfied. For what more has the wise man than the fool? You can only eat so much as... Well, I better not talk. It was a private conversation, so I can't clear it from here. Let's see if I just find it. Yeah, can I tell a story? What does the poor man have who knows how to walk before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desire. In other words, better to be a poor man who's using his eyes than to be a rich man who just constantly lives in the realm of his desire. He's always thinking about what he needs to get next to be satisfied. He misses all of life. Better to be a poor man and take a walk along the canals and to look out over the almond orchards and look at the vineyards and all of that, and to take that walk with the Lord, see the beauty of it, see the harvest has come in, see the season changing, to enjoy all of that, the reality of a moment by moment life in this world, than to be fabulously wealthy and miss all of it because I'm living in my mind and living onto the next scheme and I never come into contact with life. He says, this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Whatever one is, he has been named already, for it is known that he is man, and he cannot contend with him who is mightier than him, since there are many things that increase vanity. How is man the better? So now he tumbles down into his funk again, and he said, for who knows what is good for man in life all of the days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? Who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun? And so here he dive bombs again into his despair. But that's the way that it is. Life apart from the Lord. You just go and you go and you just get your blues albums and you just kind of put them on there. You sit in your chair. I remember before I knew the Lord, I had a little studio apartment. It was a little studio apartment, about the size of the stage right here. My living room was a living room until I folded the bed out of the wall. When I folded the bed out of the wall, it became a bedroom. But it cost me $70 a month, and I was working at a car wash while I was going to school and in Napa High, and going to school principally to play basketball. But I would sit in there, and I had a friend. Listen, you already know this is going nowhere, so just stay with me. And I had a friend who lived in the apartment next door to me, Ken Bunyard, and he's the one that introduced me to my wife, to Karen. And so I'm always thankful to him for that. But one thing I'm not thankful to him is that he had a little studio apartment right next to me. He had quadraphonic sound, which was quite a thing to have in those days. And so everything was quad in there, and he was the president of the Johnny Mathis fan club in Napa, California. So it was all, look at me, I'm as helpless as a kitten up a tree, and all of this stuff and all. But I'd sit in that room, you know, and I had my own, list of albums and stuff, and there'd just be a lot of times I'd just walk in there, have the room all dark and everything, and I just put on some down stuff, just sit there. You understand what is apart from the Lord? What in the world is this all about? You can only shoot the basketball so many times. You can only score, so many points. You can only run up and down the court so many times. I mean, that search for life and all the different ways that we searched in. So it's up and down, up and down. And that's the way that life is apart from the Lord. Oh boy, I'm a finalist in the clearinghouse. Up, and then, oh boy, I gotta buy I gotta buy their medical journal, and then I gotta buy these four books. And I know if I don't, they'll put me in the hopper that burns all these things. And so now I'm down. I mean, it's just all up and down like that. Beautiful just to have a relationship with the Lord where everything just smooth like this. I mean, not in terms of what we go through in life, but our joy is there and everything is sure and everything is steady because He is sure and steady.